You're going to have some ice cream, right?
Yeah, I'll have some ice cream. So today is September 21st, 2014, and I'm here with... Can you say your name and your... You can say your year of birth or your full birth date.
David Lee Pratt, 1943.
All right. So, David, where were you born?
Pensacola, Florida.
And what town were you... Pensacola. You were born in Pensacola. What town did you go to school in? Pensacola?
Palmyra, Illinois.
So did you grow up in Palmyra, Illinois?
Well, I spent some years there, but it was an area of little farm towns. Sometimes we'd live in one, sometimes in another. I have relatives in different little towns in that central Illinois, little farm towns. That was one of them. It was probably the biggest of the small towns in that area. It wasn't the county seat or anything. It's 900 people from.
When did you move from Pensacola to Palmyra, Illinois?
I was only about 2 years old, I think. Okay. So I don't really know for sure. Yeah, I was born during the war, after the war was over. My dad was in the Army Air Corps. It's a big base down there. I was a war baby, and after war was over, then I went back home.
And you went to school in Illinois?
Yeah.
Elementary, mm-hmm. High school?
College in Southern Illinois. And that's the first time I was ever around, you know, other races and stuff, really. But I never got to know many friends, you know. I never got close friends with anybody else, you know.
Do you remember growing up what that was like? Like, what kind of... What the community was like, who the people were that you grew up around? Did you have friends?
Well, when I was in Jerseyville, Illinois, that was a county seat. There's 5,000 people or so. I went to high school and stuff there. And it was mostly like, you know, white people, that, like a lot of farmers and, you know, and mostly white people and different Northern Europeans. But then there would be a few exotic people, like there were some Greek people that ran one of the hot dog stands or something. They would say, you know, that they're cooking cats or something like that. They said, don't eat there because they cook eat the cats or something. I don't remember or something. There was a lot of ignorance and, you know, stuff. But, and a lot of the people weren't bad people. It's just they'd never been around anywhere but right there, you know. So it was all just this exotic stuff that they couldn't understand, and then when they had to feel, made them feel insecure, so they had to feel like they were better or something, you know. I was always ready for an adventure and exploring and stuff, but, you know, I probably had a lot of attitudes imprinted on me, too, just unconscious stuff, you know. It was that, I mean, we're talking about the 40s and 50s and 60s, early 60s.
What were your parents like?
They were real nice people. You know, they both grew up on little hard scrabble farms in central Illinois, and during the Depression, a whole bunch of kids, siblings, you know. And then from when they were young into World War II, and out of World War II into little towns. My dad worked in a bank, you know.
Your dad was in the military?
Mm-hmm.
What did your mom do?
Well, when he was in the military in Pensacola, she worked sometimes. Like in dressing fish and stuff she hated, you know. And most of the time she did different things, you know. She kept the house together, did all that housewife stuff. But she was also, sometimes she'd be like president of the women's club. They'd do charitable things and stuff, you know. Relatives is all about family. Everything's about family, you know.
Do you know much about your family history as far as like where you came from and your heritage?
Not that much. It doesn't interest me that much, but I know most of the people from my dad's side were from England. But there's a lot of different kinds of people in Northern European tribes of various types, you know. My mom, they said they were Dutch, but I think that they meant German, but somewhere in that neighborhood. So it's all Anglo-Saxons and Celts and people like that, you know, Norman invasion and stuff.
Yeah. What is your earliest memory of interacting with somebody that was maybe not from America?
Well, Lower East Side in New York, probably, which was really an education that way. Because where I lived on the Lower East Side, it was mostly Puerto Rican. After Puerto Rican, it was probably Black was the next most. And then after that was probably Ukrainians and Poles. And then after that was like the Beatniks, Bohemians. And then there was other groups, you know. But in my particular neighborhood, within, say, a 10-block square, that was predominantly the way it was. But if you just walk a few blocks another way, you're in Chinatown, or you're in Little Italy, or you're in the old Jewish entertainment sector, where they used to have all the plays and stuff. You know, they had like a lot of, there was this old, great old Jewish neighborhood further downtown. Then there's the Bowery, you know, and this was all just within, and then Greenwich Village was just over there on the west side, you know. So this was all just in the same neighborhood. Easy walking, one to the other, you know. Mostly poor people down there, you know.
Wait, not anymore.
Huh?
Not anymore.
Not anymore. And it's just like, and there was this one street, Orchard Street, which was like all of these carts and stuff out on the street, just like in the movies you see of old New York. You know, it was just carts and the horses, and people are selling stuff and everything, and kids running up and down the street and all the whole thing. It was just, that's the way it was still. And that was just a couple blocks from where I was living, you know.
What year was this?
This was about six, I think I got there about 63 maybe, 62 or 63, I think. You know, so late 62 okay. Or maybe early 63, something like that.
Was this after college?
And then I left around, I think I left around 65, 66, maybe 66, something like that. So there was a lot of interaction, you know, the different kinds of culture, music and stuff, you know, and food and everything, you know. It was great. The one that was most accessible to me was the Black culture, because we shared a lot of the same, you know, they had beatniks and the jazz and the music and the dancing and the dope and everything, you know. So we shared a lot of stuff, you know. So sometimes we kind of tolerated each other, you know, or something, got along okay. Every once in a while you'd even see an intermarriage, you know. That was New Bohemia over there. Old Bohemia was on the west side, Greenwich Village and all that.
Old Bohemia, would you define that a little bit?
Well, that's where the artists and everybody lived in New York, which was Greenwich Village all the way through, and still some, you know. But then it was the new, younger people were over on the east side, because it was cheaper and everything, in the slums. It's more slums. It was not as developed. All the new young artists, they always move into the cheapest place in town. It happens every time, you know. So that was what was happening then. And that was where, you know, the little alternative newspapers and stuff were coming out, and radical organizations and stuff, you know. Hipsters then.
So at that time, were you went to college? When did you go to
college? I only went for like a year and a half because I got involved in the civil rights movement and went to jail and stuff during, you know, like exams and stuff. And I said, fuck it, I'm going to New York. You know, because you'd have to put all that stuff back together and everything, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether it's a mistake or not, but that's where I got a real education real fast, you know, the hard way. So you learn a lot. If you learn the hard way, you really learn it, you know. But I didn't get no degree or anything for that.
You got a life degree.
Huh?
You got a life degree.
Yeah, but try to, you know, nobody pays you for that.
So what did you do for work?
During that time?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of times I starved. And then I would go through, I had kind of a fun, interesting messenger job for a while. Messengers. This is before computers or anything, so you know, it's a business. People would have to send messages all over town and different things, so you jump on the train and deliver as fast as you can, you know, 14th floor up there and this and that all over New York. So that was kind of interesting. I mean, it didn't pay for shit. You could barely survive, you know. It's like, you know, mostly like old retired guys and stuff, never playing the going over the racing farm and stuff, you know. There is some colorful characters in there, I'll tell you that. I hated work. I threw that in the garbage can one day, and this and that. I'd have little jobs like that. I just one horrible job in this little sweatshop one time, making stuff for the, what is that, Lincoln Center or Kennedy Center or something up there, that big cultural thing uptown where they have all the big performances and stuff. We were making stuff for that. So it had all of this. It was a sweatshop. This Jewish guy was running it. Or maybe it was Italian. I don't remember. We had all these Puerto Ricans in there. You know, we're all sweating away. It was horrible in there. And then every once in a while, there would be some rich people who would look at my art and find it amusing or something and play around a little bit with that. You know, and that's the direction I was headed. You know,
trying to. Is this when you first were trying to become an artist? Or?
Yeah, I was an artist and trying to survive doing that, which is one main reason I was starving to death, you know. Mm-hmm. But when I had to get a job, it was usually shitty jobs like that. But I finally ended up in a Museum of Modern Art, and that was a pretty good job down in the basement doing grunt work and stuff. That was a pretty good job with benefits and stuff, you know, so I stuck with that for a little while. And then went to California. But there's a lot of, New York is great for the immigrants and all different kinds of people and stuff. It's in a small space, you know, it's like this cauldron or something, you know, bubbling. Talk about a gumbo, my God, you know. It's great for that. Culturally, it's hard to beat and stuff, you know. And so I was fortunate in that way, you know.
Do you feel like there was ever any tension between different?
Oh yeah, people are always, you know, there was gangs fighting and stuff all the time, you know. I read recently the Chinese are taking over South Manhattan, big chunks, you know, they exploded.
Uh-huh.
You know, from Chinatown, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, don't mess with Little Italy unless you're prepared for a fight, you know. So they're probably still got their little social clubs and stuff up and down the street. That's pretty cool. And they have some great festivals of great food and stuff, you know.
You worked alongside a lot of immigrant population, too.
Oh, yeah, and lived. Mostly I lived there because it's the cheapest place to live. But I worked at, like down on Wall Street as an office boy and stuff. I remember that. You know, I was going to art school sometimes and stuff.
Mark.
I worked as a delivered food from a Jewish deli, lunch hour.
Where did you go to art school?
Art Students League. Oh, and then I had an Argentine friend in there. Yeah, you know,
in the art school?
Pretty good friend. And I ran into him years later up around New Mexico, northern New Mexico, Towson, so many years later, you know. Huh?
In the art school, this is where you met the friend?
Yeah. Young art students would hang out together and stuff, you know.
And this was
get drunk together and starve together and stuff, you know.
Starve together.
Yeah.
So before you, let's go back in time a little bit. Before you went to New York, like, so talk a little bit about your high school experience and your experience prior to New York. What was that?
There wasn't hardly any immigrants, and if they were, it stuck out. Like, I remember a French girl. I don't know where she came from. And then she just lived right down the street, too. And boy, was she exotic. She came to my birthday party. You know, and she could, like, you know, juggle and stuff and, you know, could barely speak English and stuff. So when there was somebody, you know, it was really a big deal, you know.
How old were you for this party, this birthday party that was the French?
I'm just a little kid, you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Grade school, you know. But, you know, there's no hardly any ever black people or any, you know, where I lived.
This was in Illinois.
In Illinois. And then we could go down to St. Louis and then we start to see other people, you know. You roll up the window, lock the door and everything, you know. St. Louis has got a lot of soul. Still.
Yeah. Mm. Did you go there when you were in high school?
Yeah. That was the big evil city, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was that like?
Well, it was an adventure, you know. Little country kid boy, you know, into the big city. You know, they had a little entertainment district, you know, called, what do they call it? I forget, but it was kind of hot at the time. A few nightclubs, you know. So, yeah. Just big art museums. They had some good college. Still got some good colleges there. Two or three really good colleges, good newspaper.
Was there anything inspirational about that time for you?
Let's see, my high school period?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had a girlfriend I liked a lot. That was pretty inspirational. You know? High school basketball team almost got state championship one year. You know, that was a lot of fun.
You played on the basketball team?
No, I was a manager. You know, the guys that throw out the balls and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I had some friends, and then I had some teachers that were like, you know, Ashley tried or something. And in retrospect, I look back and say, well, you know, that was kind of inspirational a little bit, you know, but really, I had to get out of there, out of the Midwest in general, you know. I had to, it was driving me nuts. Felt like I was in jail or something.
You said that you got involved in the civil rights movement, and that was in college?
Yeah.
Were you particularly religious at any point in your life?
Early on, when I was a young kid, you know, I didn't know that much better, you know, it's like, go over some of that imagery and stuff, you know.
Were your parents religious?
My mom was more religious than my dad. My dad was at best an agnostic, you know. But he'd go along just to not make waves and stuff, you know. But she would like, she went Presbyterian or one of those.
What kind of politics did you grow up in with your family?
Extreme middle of the road.
Extreme middle of the road.
Yeah.
And then you got involved in the civil rights movement later on.
Yeah, and that freaked everybody out.
You know. What was that like?
Really educational, you know. And it's scary, dangerous, you know. And, I could tell something was, I'm just a crazy kid, I don't know what I was doing, I hope I didn't do more harm than good or anything, you know. It was just, it seemed like it was important for the white people to be there on those freedom rides and stuff, you know. Oh, then I went to Washington, D.C. on big peace marches and stuff, too, you know, a couple of times. But the civil rights movement, you know, and then I was hung out with the black community and the black preacher and, you know, black cellmates and stuff, you know. tried to integrate swimming pools and stuff.
Cellmates?
Huh?
You said cellmates?
Yeah, cellmates in jail. Yeah, they threw us in jail.
Oh, okay.
You know, I don't remember how we got out, but we were in there at least a few days, you know. These are not immigrants, so. Stories, so you know.
That's okay. I'm just questioning. And you don't have to go into great detail if you don't want to, but, you know, just talk a little bit about that experience and then what you decided to do after you got out.
Out of work, too. Mm-hmm. Well, then I went home, you know, for a rest break or something, trying to figure it out, and everybody was all freaked out and stuff, you know. I said, well, I want to go to New York, so they gave me, you know, a couple $100 and said, okay.
Your folks gave you the $100?
Yeah. Which I look back on it now, and I just thought, like, what a wonderful gesture from them, you know? Just saying, okay, go for it, yeah. You know? So I said, you know, I'm leaving it. So, and then there's chapter 4 or whatever you say.
So then you go to New York?
Yeah.
Tell her how you met your first wife.
Well, remember my Argentine friend? We were him and another buddy of mine from the West Coast and a few other people. We went over to the village to buy peyote. You could get peyote at that time. You could buy it. They would sell it for a dollar, what they called a buck, a dollar piece. They had bags of it. It was in the village. Because at that time, probably couldn't sell it legally on the street or anything, but you could legally get it through the mail because the feds hadn't caught up to the process yet or something. So we go over there and get the peyote. In the front room was a little art gallery. And then in the middle, you know, it was a railroad apartment, 1, 2, 3, they call them. Here they call them shotgun apartments. And, you know, with the glass front facing the street. So that was a gallery, and then the next room was, they made fake paintings where they sold, like, Blake locks and fake 19th century American painting copies, you know, and they put them in ovens and bake them and stuff, you know, and sell them as originals. That's what they did in the middle room. And then in the back room, they sold sacks, sold peyote in a dollar a button. So we'd go over there and buy all that peyote and eat it up and walk around New York and stuff. One time, we were riding escalators in the Port Authority Bars Terminal, and the cops took us in the back room and beat the shit out of us.
Why?
Because they thought we were junkies or something, because we were crazy looking and stuff, you know, and riding up and down the escalators and going, wow. And then so, you know, the cops beat us up and they turned us loose and we go out. And there's 42nd Street and everything, 3 o'clock in the morning, you know. Oh, my God. And that was all before this, though. And 42nd Street was like a Hieronymus Bosch in those days, you know. Mm-hmm. So we used to eat peyote and run around New York and do crazy shit like that all the time, you know.
So your wife was there at the gallery? Or?
Huh?
Your wife was there at the gallery? Or?
No, this was later. I don't remember exactly how much later or anything, but me and my friends, we ate some peyote, and we used to go to this bar called Stanley's that's on the Lower East Side. It was kind of a hangout, beatnik hangout, you know. It was a regular thing. I lived close there almost most of the time. I lived in New York. It was by Tompkins Square, which is the big square in the area. And it was old Polish bar, you know. Real old time 19th century bar. It was really cool. And it's sort of beatniks were. And so I was hanging out there. So I was eating peyote and hanging out. That's where I met her, was that night that I was eating that peyote, you know. So we went through all these adventures that night and stuff. And I was still up, walking around the next day trying to come down. And Kennedy was shot. Got shot. I was peyote-fied when he got shot.
Wow.
So that you can, I can locate that in days. So I met my wife, who I ended up being married to 20-something years or something. Kennedy was shot, and I ate peyote, you know, that night. And everything in the world has changed since then. Right then, it was a big change for me and the rest of the world. You know, right then. Yeah. And that peyote went all the way to New York, and me and that peyote got together somehow, which is very mysterious to me. And I've had a relationship one way or another with that peyote ever since. And that was years before I went to a meeting here, and, you know.
So you got married pretty much immediately to this woman?
Yeah, in the Church of Scientology.
Really?
Yeah, within, I think, just a few weeks after that or something, yeah.
So the Church of Scientology was a...
She was into that stuff. I always thought it was a bunch of crap. But she was into it, and it was cheap and everything, you know.
What was that experience like? Did you get involved in it?
It was a big drag, I thought, you know, and her mom and dad was there, and their dad couldn't stand me, and the whole, you know, it's Scientology and this and that, you know, and we have to go get dressed up and do all this stuff, you know, and everything. I mean, I felt good about her. I liked her and everything, you know, and stuff.
Did you practice at all, any of the...
Scientology? Mm-hmm. I went to a couple of their things and lectures and stuff. You know, there was one guy in there I thought was a pretty good guy, and he was rich, and he was a serious art collector. You know, I thought, I like kind of like that guy. And then he gave me some jobs cleaning up, painting his house or his apartment or something. So he was all right, and most of those people are just crazy as far as I can. Some... tell, you know, some of them are smarter than others, and it's hard to figure out what their motivations are exactly. I think mostly just ego or something. Who knows? Anyway, it wasn't for me, you know. In fact, they didn't like me so much they excommunicated me, made me an enemy of Scientology or something. Something like that. I thought that was pretty cool, you know. Because I didn't want to go along with the program or something, you know, I had the wrong attitude, you know. I've always had kind of an attitude problem, you know. And she still goes for crazy shit like that from what I can tell.
Yeah.
So you were married to her for 20 years. What was that like?
We were married for 15
years. 15.
15 years.
See, she knows more about... You should be interviewing her. Well, let me get some coffee or some beer or something.
Okay. We can pause.
You want anything? Ice cream?
Oh, I'm good right now.
You want anything?
I'm good.
Resume recording here. Let's see. Here we go. Okay. Back to the recording.
What are we talking about? I forgot.
Well, you were... We ended off with you talking about you had a wife that you were married to for 15 years.
Yeah.
So after, well, you guys must have went somewhere together. Where did you go after New York?
California. But you know, I just realized something. I'm the immigrant because I'm going into other. I'm that guy out going into somebody else's culture. You know. Or environment or something. So I'm the immigrant in this story. A lot of the time. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's what I know about immigrants. You know?
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I was interested in other cultures, and sometimes I find myself in the middle of other cultures. You know? They might have been there a while, wherever they were. Maybe a long time. Maybe just a generation or something. But it wasn't my culture, you know. I was so we went from New York to California, and there was all that 60s stuff out of California, you know. Went through all that. Some of it was interesting. Still, I think. Mm-hmm. You know. But a lot of it was just, it couldn't make any sense. It's just a big explosion of stuff, you know. But some things come out of that a little bit, you know, and some of the people that I was around were interesting politically, interesting spiritually, you know.
What was the
interesting experiments in the arts and in lifestyle, mm-hmm. you know, changes in the arts, right in the middle of that, socially.
What did you immigrate into? Do you remember?
Well, in California, I didn't. I was hung out mostly with, you know, I had some black friends and this and that, but mostly it was just white people, you know. I did have some, by then, though, I did have a few serious black friends. And I don't remember somebody, who else I know. I'm sure they had occasions I had some friends, but nobody, like, was real close to. Mostly that period was white people. But when I moved to northern New Mexico, I was in the middle. There was hard. Sometimes there wasn't any other white people around for a long ways. You know?
When you went to California, did you hang out on Haight-Ashbury when you first got there?
No, but I hung out in Haight-Ashbury a lot, but I never ever actually lived there. I stayed with some people for a while that were close to there. But I hung out there a lot, you know.
Were you in, so you were in San Francisco?
I lived in Marin County, just north of San, most of the time. Just north of San Francisco, you know.
Did you work there?
As little as possible. I don't remember hardly ever working, you know. I got a couple of billboard commissions and stuff like that. Yeah. No, I was up. I was looking for another way, a better way. Still am.
How did you end up at Morningstar? Did you just hear about it? How did you end up at Morningstar?
Oh, I was in Haight-Ashbury and the diggers were going on. And the diggers are like feeding people. You know, they were like kind of the political wing of the movement, and they were. I thought they were kind of heroic. You know, it was like Robin Hood or something. You know, and then all of these hungry hippies were being fed in the park. It's, you know, big 5-foot containers of beans and stuff. You know,
what was Morningstar?
Well, I haven't got there yet.
Okay.
So these were the diggers. And so I kind of admired the diggers, and then one day I saw a poster say, hey, come on up to the digger farm, you know, and you can stay and we can help harvest the apples and stuff. Well, somehow Lou Gottlieb, he was up there, he's retired, and he had like 40 acres up there, nuts, apple orchards. It's real nice, Sonoma County, not far from the ocean, it's real pretty up there. The digger somehow got in on that, because Ramon and everybody knew everybody at that time. I mean, the movers and shakers, it was the beginning of a lot of stuff, so. So somehow diggers got in and said, oh, it's the digger farm, you know. But I never heard Lou call it that. So people would show up, you know, straggle in and stuff and look around. Hey, it's pretty cool. So build a treehouse in Redwoods, you know. So I remember food stamps first came out. We managed to get some of those sometimes. Ate a lot of, like, you know, grains and beans and cheap stuff. And there's a lot of wild fruit and stuff. It's California, you know. Whatever you could get by to manage to survive, you know, would buy things. If you got enough people, you'd buy stuff in bulk and stuff, you know. There's diggers that would hang out there sometimes. So that was that was Morningstar. What they called the digger farm was called Morningstar. Before it was called the digger farm, but it was never called the digger farm, really. So there were all these people up there, and it was all a big experiment. Some of them were smart, and some of them were just desperate, and there's all kinds of crazy people, and people that were trying to do something with it, and this people with all different kinds of motivations and orientations and all kinds of different drugs and experiments and everything, you know. The whole alternate universe, build it yourself from the beginning, out of chaos. See what you can do with it, you know. Now, Lou and Ramon and a lot of the core people were kind of on a spiritual path already, so that kind of helped a lot to focus some of it, you know. And then there was people that could grow stuff, you know, and the pioneer ecologists and conceptual people. And there's a few people like that. mostly like a lot of crazy people that couldn't live. If they lived somewhere else, they'd be arrested or something just for being too weird. You know, we didn't throw anybody out or anything. Bikers, you know.
Was it a transient yoga population? People.
Huh?
Was it like a transient population?
Yeah, it would constantly change, but you had your kind of core people that were kind of always there, you know, and people that were there consistently for longer periods, and then there was a lot of other people just going through from different periods of time and stuff, come and go, you know, different relationships. Some of those people were interesting, you know. A lot of them are gone now. And some of them shot off and kept on going, experimenting with utopian communities and stuff, you know. Some of them went back into whatever they were came from. Some of them become academics or car salesmen or, you know, insurance salesmen.
And there was no immigrant population on Morningstar, really?
Well, there were occasionally, but mostly it was America. Mostly it was... It was hippies, you know, most kind of hippies, you know. So minorities and poor people were less common than white kids, but there were, I would say, maybe 15-20% black, and, you know, there's some Asians out there in the West Coast that come through, you know.
Well, let me get a pause for a second, because I have to, okay, so.
We could have been here generations and generations. We're still in immigrants, as far as they're concerned.
So where did you go after after California?
Not into Mexico. To hang out with the Indians and stuff, which I ended up doing, you know.
You spent a lot of time there.
More than 15 years, from like the late 60s, early 70s to the late 70s, early 80s.
Were you still married then?
Yeah.
Same person?
To the same person, when I met in New York, yeah. Then that's where we split up, up in Taos, you know. And then I lived down in Pewaukee for a while, north of Santa Fe, and then eventually moved here about 85.
So you have two kids.
Yeah.
And they were both born in New Mexico?
One of them was born here, actually. It's a long story. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But the other one was born. The other one was born in, I'm not sure where Ross was born. Probably Colorado. Or maybe out somewhere, Illinois or someplace, I think. No talent. His mom moved around a lot.
But you guys weren't together when he was born?
No. But she came back soon after that, the kid. She was pregnant. She took off. Just about did me in, you know. And, you know, my dog died and this truck stopped running it. My mother had a heart attack. Yeah, it took me a while to get myself back together, you know. And then she showed up with the kid again, you know. So I gave her my best shot, but that only lasted about 3 months or something.
And then she took off again.
And then she took off again, yeah. So I said, screw that, you know. I went up there to see him a couple of times, you know.
But all this time you stayed in New Mexico?
No, I moved to Texas at 85.
Okay.
You know, Austin. I had a few friends here, and it wasn't that I was moving to Austin so much, it was just that I was moving away from where I was, you know, and I tried to figure out different things, and I kind of like settled on Austin for various reasons. One of them was every time I ever talked to anybody who had been there, their eyes were kind of light up, you know. And I would start looking, I said, well, I know a couple of people, so it's not too far, you know. I figured if I went to Mexico, it'd be too big a change. I don't know the language or anything. I already had West Coast experience. I was tired of the winters where I was. It gets really cold, so I wasn't going to go north. You know, I considered New Orleans a little bit.
They started the second Morningstar in New Mexico.
Yeah, it was Morningstar in New Mexico.
Is that how you ended up in New Mexico?
Huh?
Was that how you ended up in New Mexico?
No, I went there before, I went there and kind of started it. Me and some friends, a few friends, took off from there. That was true. Let's see. Where's the first place we lived? It was Anconas. It was this old ghost town down by the Vicedos River. Out in the middle of nowhere. Beautiful country up there. This part is fun. This is the party part. I think I'll drink a beer too. Want a beer?
Sure.
Want a beer?
Okay.
Oh no, I'm okay. I need this drink. So. You went out to New Mexico, Morningstar, you worked with Morningstar, you kind of started that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Me and a few friends. I lived in Truchas, that was all, we were immigrants in Truchas, that's for sure. They chased us out of that town. That was before we started Morningstar. We were all, it was all California Morningstar kind of accumulated there. We were the first there, and then people started showing up at the door. Trying to figure it out. And the local people got violent and stuff and chased stuff down. So we dealt a little bit with the state of New Mexico. It was already assigned a liaison person because there had been a bunch of murders and rapes and stuff against hippies, you know. So that's when we got the Morningstar because the Morningstar was owned by this rich white guy that spent time in Millbrook with it's a long, complicated story.
Yeah. Well, you really were the immigrants, though, in that neighborhood.
Exactly.
That neighborhood, those people had probably been there forever.
Forever, yeah. Since the Spanish conquistadors.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not even Mexican. So we're not Mexican. We never, our people never ever lived in Mexico. We came right here from, in the beginning.
Sure.
You know, it wasn't Mexico when we came up. So my immigrant story is I'm the immigrant a lot of the time, see. In a way.
Where were you living? Like, what was your living situation like when you were in, when you were there in New Mexico?
Well, at first it was that old ghost town I was telling you about, and it's really a beautiful, enchanted place. We see peyote down here, and this beautiful, clean river come out of these canyons, you know, stuff, like mountains, wildlife, old adobe ruins and stuff, cemeteries. It was cool, but, you know, it was rugged, and, you know, people were, didn't like us because they're different and insensitive to their culture and stuff, you know. Just a bunch of crazy kids, we should have known better, you know. But there was no kind of excuse for that kind of behavior. We weren't, you know, they were violent against us, you know.
These were local people, like?
Local people, yeah.
In New Mexico, and they were, like, Hispanic?
Spanish, yeah.
Spanish?
Mostly.
Didn't somebody get shot?
Oh, yeah, stabbed. People always get stabbed and shot and raped and stuff. Houses burned down. Yeah. So we were the immigrants. We were the refugees. And then, well, first we were the immigrants, and then we were the refugees. So we built our own stuff. There. This guy, he owned this property. He was one of these rich people that moved up around there. It's beautiful up there, up around town. And bought some big chunk of property, which it does. They should probably get fairly cheap. You know, he's from rich tobacco southern aristocracy or something. But he used to hang out in Millbrook with Timothy Leary and those guys. And he was good friends with a good friend of mine, who was an old Morningstar guy. He was from New York, this Jewish guy from New York. He was ex-junkie. They both had girlfriends that were in the funny farm, the same funny farm, and they escaped them out of the funny farm together. They were all at Millbrook initially. Everybody was experimenting with LSD in the very early days and stuff. And then the two girlfriends ended up in the funny farm, so they escaped them out. I knew both of those girls. They were funny. and one of them, my Facebook friend, you know, she's down in Albuquerque now. She apparently she kind of got herself back together. And her, my friend died, you know. But anyway, they were friends, and he had all the property, so we moved up there and just tried to get it together and learn how to make adobes. It was about that first year, I think there was maybe 30, 40 of us. We had nothing. You know, we had some bags of beans and, you know, hammer and saw and, you know, a truck. Enough shelter and stuff to get through the first winter. Try to grow stuff. You know, grow some food and this and that. And all kinds of, it's a long story.
So you survived it.
Yeah, just barely. I don't know how I did it. Guardian angel, I think. Because I took every wrong turn, still have so far. Path less travel. Where were we? Immigrant, see? I'm the immigrant, see? Yeah. Still. Right now, as we speak.
We're in the minority.
We're in the minority.
Oh.
Once again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where you're living now. This
yeah,
is.
Yeah, right now.
What's the population primarily in this neighborhood?
Hispanic. And then there's some black people, but I say in this particular neighborhood, it's just greater white people.
Three quarter Latino and
yeah.
One quarter white.
And then the white people, there's some of them are old timers, there's Czechs and Germans, and some of them are more people, like people came out here from Austin in the 60s because it was cheaper.
Yeah,
so
old hippies.
Yeah.
Paramount old hippies.
Yeah.
A lot of gay people.
And gay people. And the black people, you know, it's great. It's a great mix, you know.
Sort of what you're used to.
Yeah, but these people in this particular neighborhood, for me, it takes a long time to get to know anybody. It's all about live and let live, you know. Mm-hmm. And they're not like unfriendly. They just live and let live, you know. And there's different ones, and there may be some like drug dealing or something going on, because there's from people from Central America, they're like kind of trying to be anonymous or something.
I bet there's a pretty healthy amount of illegals in this neighborhood.
Right, or something, and maybe this guy down here with this business might be tied or this and that. There's all stuff like that. It's kind of underground. There might be a little meth or something here and here. And then there's a few black people down this way. And a lot of them are harsh people. A lot of the Hispanics go back a ways. And the blacks here, they go back a ways. Like not long after the Civil War, there was a lot big migration, you know. And property owners of generations. And then you get a few guys with Confederate flags in the back of their truck and guns and stuff, you know, pit bulls, you know, and driveways with no trespassing signs and stuff, you know, camouflage, shoot their guns off. So it's interesting. But it takes a while to get to know people. But like we're starting, I'm kind of figuring out who some of the people are. You know, some of the movers and shakers in the community, you know, culture.
Are you the only artist here?
No, there's some artists around.
Yeah, none that we know.
Huh?
None that we know. We're the advanced wave here. But I think it will come eventually.
None artists that we know.
No other artists that we know right in our neighborhood.
Oh, not right
we
here,
know.
No, but yeah. Snap across the street, you know. And,
yeah.
People
yeah.
Up in Elgin.
So, David, I'm going to ask you a couple of quick questions,
okay.
And then we can pause. So, You came to Austin in 1985.
Yeah.
And what do you do for a living?
Well, the first real job I got was at Whole Foods. I worked in their second and third store in produce. And I did that for not that long, a few years. And then I got this security job down at Lakeway Marina because I knew the guy that was had the job and he got it for me. And he quit. That was Tommy Hancock. He had that job and he thought of me and I got the job. And I did that for 20 years or something. You know, nighttime.
But you're primarily an artist.
Well, I don't know. It depends on how you define it, you know. I'd like to think of myself that way. Not that that's that special or anything, really, you know. But to me, that's the way I think of myself. But in terms of, I do a lot of different other things. And how many hours do I put into security, for example? Probably a lot more than I put into art. So maybe I was, at that time, I was a security guy. I wasn't an artist. I was a dabbler, maybe, you know. See? Yeah. So it all depends on how you look at it and how you define it and stuff. That's what I would like to do. And plus, realistically, where else am I going to make any money? Except in the arts. Serious money. And even that's kind of a long shot. You know? So I think about it that way, but also because it's not, that's what I do. You know, that's what I do. Like some people think, you know what I mean? It's something that comes out of humans. You know? Some of it's mysterious, but there it is, and I'm glad it's there. What would this world be like if it wasn't there? Hey, think about that. No music, no literature, no painting, you know, no dance. What kind of world would that be? You know? Not one worth living in that I can figure out. So it's part of what we have to pay. It's a way of paying for our being here. It's a contribution. People don't see that. They think you're sucking it instead of putting something in. You're taking something out. Mm. You know? So it's not everybody. You got to be tough. You know? And some people hang in there, and I'm glad they do, and I do the best I can, but I get sidetracked on a lot of other stuff, too. I'm interested in a lot of different things, and I have certain responsibilities I try to meet and take care of as much as I can, you know? So, I make art sometimes. It's one of the things I really like. That's what I really like to do, that, yeah. It's one of the things that I do, yeah.
And you're married now to your second wife, who's here, Susan?
Yeah.
Third wife. Oh, there was a wife in between?
Ross's mom.
Oh, you guys got married? I didn't know that.
Yeah. You got married a long time ago.
I didn't realize you guys
were married. You and Ross's mom.
Huh? You were married to Ross's mom?
Yeah. Yeah, for a very short time.
Okay.
Like 3 months.
So your third wife, Susan, is here.
Yeah.
And you have been married for how long?
We got married in 2000, but we've been together, we figured out for about 23 years.
For 23 years.
Yeah, longer than anybody else.
And Susan, you're an artist as well?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm finally letting myself call myself that. Since I'm in my 60s, and you know, when I was younger, I didn't feel like I earned the title, but I feel like I kind of have kind of earned it.
That's when you get a certain age, you can say stuff and get away with it.
Yeah.
You know.
I've never been arrested, and I'm a grandma. Who's gonna throw me in jail?
Yeah.
I seriously considered a life of crime. I really have. A perfect candidate for
it. People think you're harmless.
So, David, this is my last question, unless you have anything else to add. But, you know, what would you say? You've identified yourself as an immigrant in a different capacity than what probably most of society thinks of as an immigrant. But what would you say your legacy is that you would like to leave behind for your family and friends? Like, you know, as an immigrant, for example, like, what would you like to leave them knowing with all the struggles you've been through?
Smokes. I get what you see is what you get. I don't know, you know, what else? I don't know. You know? I mean, I already. that's it. What I'd like to leave more if I could, or something, you know. Mostly, it's not stuff that I want to leave. It's a way, you know, or it's an approach to living in a good way somehow. You know, if I can somehow leave a path or something. Nobody has to take the path, but if they want to, it might be helpful. That's why we all want to leave something, right? You want to leave something positive, you know, for future generations. I don't have I don't see no point in having a memorial, or, you know, what's the point of that, or, you know, although, you know what I was thinking would be cool? A little, like, in terms of, like a physical memorial, a little something from it, from events.
Oh, yeah.
And just a little something.
You mean to hold the ashes or mark
them? Or just say, you know, David Lee Pratt, 1943, to,
oh.
Or whatever, you know. I don't even have to be buried there. It's just a mark, you know. Wouldn't take up too much space or anything, you know.
Come up with a phrase, you
know. Or you could, or whatever. No. Not no big deal or anything, just a little.
I feel what you're saying.
Yeah, just a little something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know. I could make that would be nice to leave. But really, would you just do the best you can to leave something? Leave something positive, you know. It took, but hopefully, I did a lot of harm already, so I can't clean everything up or anything like that, but I could try not to do no more harm, you know. These are kind of abstract things, you know. Everything in the physical world changes so fast and everything, you know, anyway. That doesn't last long. But, you know, we know, we do leave, there is a kind of immortality, because I talk to people that were important in my life all the time. See? You leave that. I consult with them. You know? So there, and that's not all. But that's something right there. But these are like abstract things, not physical things. It's too, everything's changing. So it'd be nice to have something here going for, leave a little something, help. Give a little boost if that's possible. But all that stuff changes so fast, unless you're going for something really big, it's too late for that. And even then, to say, hey, you make it out of marble or something, it might last a few hundred years. You know, or either people that really make big changes in the world or something like that. That doesn't happen that often. And so even thinking about leaving something, you know,
a big
legacy of some kind. I would like to have my art. It'd be great if people would look at my art. I don't know if that's going to happen or not, one way or another. Somebody maybe get some enjoyment or something out of that. That would be great. I would like that.
Yeah.
You know, or some money even or something. But my experience, there's no guarantee about that or anything else. You know, so I try not to be attached to anything physical like that, you know.
Well, is there anything you want to add?
Can't think of nothing.
Okay. Susan?
Oh, just glad you did this.
I'm glad I did too.
Yeah, and that stuff's in there and rolling it out. And what I like about it is it helps to keep the facts straight, because people talk about this and that, and I know from experience they don't know what they're talking about because I was there sometimes.
Mm-hmm.